the brain supersymmetry breaking in type 1 string theory and discuss the main consequences. So the mechanism consists of implement stable configurations of brains with anti-brains or brains with orientifolds, which present different number of supersymmetries in a way that the system breaks supersymmetry globally on the brains. The orientifolds are non-dynamical brains, which have no localized degrees of freedom, as I mentioned yesterday, and they can have either positive or negative tension. In some convention, these are the charges of the brains and orientifolds. So normalizing the charge of the brain to be positive and the positive tension, of course. An anti-brain has a negative charge, always positive tension. And then the orientifolds, there are two types of orientifolds with their associated anti-orientifolds, what I call minus and plus. The orientifold minus plane have opposite charge and negative tension, while the orientifold plus has positive tension, and therefore it has the same quantum numbers as a deep brain. So, for instance, if you the supersymmetry is broken if you combine a brain with anti-brain, or a brain with an anti-orientifold plus, or an anti-brain with orientifold plus. And in general, a system a brain with if you break supersymmetry by combining a brain with orientifold, then there is no tachyon because the orientifold has no degrees of freedom on it. However, a brain with anti-brain can give lead to tachyons if they are of the same type. However, if there are this, different type, they don't lead to tachyons. For instance, if you combine a D9 brain with anti-D5 brain, then this system, although not supersymmetric, is stable. There is no tachyon. So just to give you an idea, the simplest model, the simplest construction that you can do is in 10 dimensions. So I remind you that the 10-dimensional type 1 theory can be obtained by projecting the spectrum of type 2b with a world seat evolution omega which exchanges left and right movers. By imposing the projection to be plus 1, creates an orientifold minus 9 plane, that means it covers a whole space. Here this trivial case, which has a opposite charge and negative tension, and in units 16, the charge is cancelled if you add 16 D9 brains, but then simultaneously you cancel the tension, and this system is supersymmetric. The gauge group is not a unitary group, it's an orthogonal because the presence of the orientifold, or if you want the presence, the projection omega in the open string sector, anti-symmetrizes the Champanton indices, in other words, the indices of the deep brains. So instead of producing a unitary group, you produce an SO32. Yes. They go together. Okay. I mean, they go together, these two. Try to explore.
There seems to be something arbitrary in the starting point. In other words, it seems that you have enough freedom to construct many possible models at low energy.
Right, yeah.
And how do you select the ones that you think are winning?
Well, that's a question of model building. And here I describe just the mechanism of breaking supersymmetry. Then, of course, in order to construct a model which contains a standard model, we require some model building, and the procedure is not unique, of course. You have just a framework, and then you can do model building.
Are you saying that this mechanism for breaking supersymmetry is the only possible one, or...?
In fact, there are two ways to break supersymmetry on the brains. The one is the one that I'm describing now, and the other is by introducing brains at angles, intersections, which is... This is the dual to introduce magnetic fields in the internal directions. I mean, both ways have been studied. They give similar effects. So I describe this one for the case because it's more simple, but the other also has similar properties. So what I was saying here is that the simplest way to introduce a different orientiful which breaks supersymmetry is by change the sign of the projection from plus one to minus one. Then this transforms the orientiful minus planes to orientiful plus planes, which have plus charge and positive tension. Therefore, the charge conservation, or if you want the Gauss law in the compact space, imposes that now that you must add 16 anti-D9 brains to cancel the charge, but now the anti-D brains have positive tension, so the tension is added. If you want, this system conserves different number of supersymmetries between the orientifuls and the D brains, and therefore supersymmetry is broken. Now, the way that it is broken is as follows. This projection now symmetrizes the bosons, but anti-symmetrizes the fermions. As a result, the gauge group is not SO32, it's SP32, but the fermions remain in the antisymmetric representation because still the antisymmetrized. So this is, I would say, the simplest model in 10 dimensions, but the spirit is the same. In other words, this contraction can be generalized in lower dimensions upon compactification or putting other type of brains and so on. Now, a first... Observation of this mechanism is that this simple model is that the tension is not cancelled, as I mentioned, and therefore that implies that the theory has this model has a three-level cosmological constant, which is, if you want, a potential for the dilaton, which is localized. Localized here is a nine brain, so it's everywhere. So that is the first point that I would like to discuss. I mean, one thing one could do is to try to use this three-level potential in order to fix some of the radii. To do that, it is easy to convince that you need brains and anti-brains of the same type, both nine brains and five brains. And the first model in which you can do such a minimization is by going to six dimensions and doing also an orbifold T4 over Z2. Then this model in general needs D9 brains and anti-D9 brains, as well as D5 brains and anti-D5 brains. The tadpole cancellation conditions, or the charge conservation, if you want, is that the number of brains minus anti-brains of the same type is 16 or minus 16, depending what is the projection. And then this is the three-level potential. There is one term which grows with the volume of the four-dimensional internal space of the T4. And this comes from the nine brains. And there is another term which decreases with the volume, and this comes from the D5 brains. Here I am in the Einstein frame, where I normalize the kinetic terms to one. So this potential obviously has a minimum in with respect to before, if I fix the dilaton, and this minimum fixes the volume of the internal space to be the ratio of the two types of anti-Debreins. Now, the of course, at the minimum of the potential, you need that the minimum potential is not zero, so you generate a potential for the dilaton, which is runaway, and that's a generic property of these models. So the question is that I'm going to address is, since we would like to discuss and the physics of such models, we'd like to find ways to avoid this three-level potential for the dilaton. And this is what I'm going to describe now. A way to avoid this three-level potential of the dilaton, which also generates tadpoles for Nevesworth fields for the dilaton. Once you have it, since it is runaway, you have tadpoles. A way to evade it is by introducing a small supersymmetry break in the bulk by imposing Serre Schwarz boundary conditions. By small, I mean, clarified in a moment, I mean a breaking which goes to zero with the size of the bulk. So if the bulk eventually is a very large millimeter bulk, then this breaking is tiny compared to the TV breaking that you introduce from the brains. Now, the simplest example of such boundary condition is by considering an interval simultaneously, because I want to have this boundary condition simultaneously with the presence of orientifolds, is by introducing an interval which can be obtained by modding out the circle by Z2. Which has two endpoints, 0 and pi r. And now there are two operations. The first is the orbifold projection by the Z2, which transforms the circle to an interval. And the second is the Serre Schwarz boundary conditions, which in the simplest case consist of imposing periodic boundary conditions for the bosons and antiperiodic for the fermions, so it's like temperature type. Which of course breaks supersymmetry. Now, with respect to this Z2, the fields are even or odd. So, for instance, if we look at the bosons, which are periodic, there are fields which are even under Z2 and fields which are odd under Z2. These fields can be expanded in a Fourier modes in the extra dimension, the y coordinate along the interval, using cosines or sines, obviously. Now, the fermions are antiperiodic, so they can be also even or odd, so they can be expanded in cosines or sines. But there is a different the difference compared to the previous expansion is that because of the antiperiodic conditions, the Kaluza-Klein modes are shifted by a half, and that's how you see in the spectrum that supersymmetry is broken. So this breaking of supersymmetry is, I would say, in the bulk. By bulk, I mean along the interval. Okay. However, I would like to see what happens at the two ends. So let us examine what happens to the supersymmetry parameter. The supersymmetry parameter is a fermion, so it's also antiperiodic. And so it has an expansion of this form. It has an even part and an odd part. This even part and odd part can be thought as the two components, the two chiral spinors, starting from five dimensions and going to four. You see that at y equals 0, the odd part vanishes, and the even part remains. So that means that at y equals 0, at the one end of the interval, in fact, half of the supersymmetry remains, which corresponds to the even super to the even spinor if you want the left spinor in some convention, while in the other end it is the even part which vanishes and the odd part which remains. So that means that this breaking of supersymmetry is can be thought as a breaking along the interval in a way that the two ends respect opposite one supersymmetry but opposite side, opposite type, one the left spinor, the other the right spinor, and therefore supersymmetry is broken globally. So if you do this compactification in type 1 theory, then at the two ends you have two orientifolds. In fact, in this in the convention that I mentioned previously are orientifolds of negative tension, which has so and then there is one orientifold and one anti-orientifold because they respect different type of supersymmetries, which have a minus charge and positive and plus charge in the correspondingly in the two ends. Now we introduce the brains to cancel the charge. So we have to introduce at the same time d-brains and anti-d-brains, and there are two ways to do it. The first way is to put the brains on top of the orientifolds and the anti-brains on top of the anti-orientifold. Then what happens is that you cancel simultaneously the charge and the tension. So every system at every end, the spectrum of these d-brains will be supersymmetric, but the supersymmetry is of different type in the two ends. In fact, a d-brain, since it is a dynamical object, it has two supersymmetries. One is the even supersymmetry, let's say, is realized linearly, while the odd supersymmetry is realized non-linearly. And this is because you have two supersymmetries in the bulk. Similarly, an anti-d-brain has a linear supersymmetry, which is the odd part, and a non-linear, which is the even part. So if you put the d-brains here, you see that the even supersymmetry is the linear one is the one that survives at this end, and the odd supersymmetry is the one that survives in the other end. So this is what I will call model 1. The model 1 has local charge conservation and brain supersymmetry. That is, the spectrum on the brain, it is locally supersymmetric, although supersymmetry is broken in the bulk along the interval. However, one can do a different construction, which is what I will call model 2, is to exchange the positions of brains with anti-brains. Then I put the anti-brain here and the brain there. Then what you in this case you see that the charge does not cancel locally but cancels only globally, but that is fine because the Gauss law tells you only that globally the charge should cancel, not locally. The tension is canceled locally, but now supersymmetry in every end is broken. And the reason is that if I put the anti-brain here, then the anti-brain has an odd supersymmetry which is linear, which is broken, because this end does not have odd supersymmetry, while the even supersymmetry is realized non-linear. So the spectrum of this brain, of this anti-brain here, is not supersymmetric. Similarly, on the other end. So this model 2 has the property that the spectrum is not supersymmetric, so supersymmetry is broken on the brain. But it has a nonlinear supersymmetry which survives, and furthermore, you don't have you have only global charge conservation.
Is that model stable? Do the brains attract each other?
If the size in this model, if the size of the interval becomes less than the string size, the string length, then you will create tachyon, of course. If you keep them apart, there is no tachyon.
The supersymmetric is a BPS condition that makes things cancel, the long range forces cancel, but if it's not supersymmetric, does that still happen?
Yes, because they are put on the orientifolds, on the fixed point, if you want, of the orbifold. So the only way to create tachyonic instability is when the size of the interval becomes less than the string length. If you keep, if the size of the interval is large compared to the string length, then there is no then the system is stable.
Would that involve some trip up to like a brain and anti-brain?
Sorry?
What if I said something like, I thought the motivation for the orange flows in the deep brain was that if I just took the brain and anti-brain, then they could have moved
to the annihilated,
and that would not
be stable. Yeah, but if I displace the brains from the ends, then of course I can they can start to move, okay, and they can annihilate. However, once the brains are put in the at the ends, the only way to move them is to shrink the interval.
Yeah,
so that's what I'm saying, that if you keep the interval, the radius which is bigger than the
But if you don't stabilize the radius, why doesn't the whole metric just want to shrink? Why doesn't the space just want to shrink? I can ask you this later.
Yeah, okay. So the if the, the conclusion here that you had is that you have no linear supersymmetry of the brain. Okay, this is a general result. Every time that you break supersymmetry on the brain while the bulk is supersymmetric, you can there is a puzzle how the, this non-supersymmetric field theory, let's say, on the brain couples to the supergravity. The answer to that is that there is a non-linear supersymmetry realized on the brain, non-linear in the sense of Volkov-Akulov. It must be a Goldstino, although the spectrum is non-supersymmetric, it must be a Goldstino which lives on the brain. And then the question is, what is a Goldstino? For instance, if I take the model that I described in the beginning, the simplest one, you can ask the question, what is the Goldstino here? The gauge group is SP32, and the fermion is the anti-symmetric representation. Now, the observation is that this anti-symmetric representation of SP32 is not an irreducible representation. It's a reducible one, and it has a singlet component, and this singlet component is the Goldstino of the nonlinear supersymmetry. So that is a generic property. So that this is the case of this example. Now, if you construct another example similar to, I mean, along the lines of the model that I described before with the circ short, with the circ shorts, then you find, I mean, the simplest construction is to go to 9 dimensions, and then you have D8 brains in the two ends, and the gauge group is in model 2. Is SO16 or SO16? The two models, model 1 and model 2, are the two models that I mentioned before, the one that preserves supersymmetry in the brain and the other that not. In both cases, the gauge group is SO16 or SO16 in every end. But in the second, in the model 2, the fermions are in the symmetric representation, which again is reducible. It has a singlet component, and this is the Goldstino. So this is a general property. Now, this Goldstino, strictly speaking, is exact and massless in the limit where the you send the size of the interval to infinity, so that in this limit, the breaking of the bulk goes to zero, and then you have an however, the supersymmetry is non-broken on the brain, and there is a massless Goldstino, which is exactly massless. However, in the case where the size of the bulk is finite, then eventually this Goldstino will acquire a mass, but this mass will be suppressed by the volume of the bulk. So you can study the effective field theory, which describes the interactions of this Goldstino, in the limit where the bulk becomes infinite, because then there are small corrections. The effective field theory, so I call here the Goldstino by chi, and some fermions which live on the brain, F, matter fermions. Then this the lowest interactions are four fermion interactions with two derivatives. So they are dimension 8 operators because you have because you have a Goldstino, because the translation symmetry of the Goldstino. And then there are just from the type of contraction of indices, there are two type of terms, generic terms that you can write down, which have been studied in the past by these people. Now, one of the two terms has a coupling which is fixed completely by the nonlinear supersymmetry of the Goldstino. It has a parameter which is a decay constant, V, capital V. And the other term has a coupling which is model dependent, is not fixed by the nonlinear supersymmetry. Now, in the context of string theory, you can compute both terms. So the first term, in fact, is a confirmation of the nonlinear of the result of the nonlinear supersymmetry, and you find that the decay constant of the Goldstino is given by the tension, the total tension of the brains, which are at every end, while the coefficient of the other term, normalized appropriately, is either 0 or plus 1, depending if the fermions on the brain have the same or opposite internal helicity with respect to the Goldstino. This is in the case where the fermions correspond to open strings with both ends on parallel on the same brains. In other words, if they correspond to intersections, then it's more complicated. Sorry?
Linear?
No.
Your interaction is just called
Yes, that's good.
Linear in Goldstino.
The Goldstino is a fermion. How is it possible? No, there is no linear.
Fermion?
No. No, think of it, the fermions are matter fermions, so they have gauge degrees of freedom. You cannot have linear interaction.
Fermion and colors and Goldstino.
Ah, with scalars. Scalars if they exist in the brain, but it may be that they don't exist. No, in this example that I saw, there are no fermions. There are no scalars. If you put scalars, then you will have other couplings also with scalars. Well, in this limit, it decouples, no? Because the size of the bulk is infinite, so there is no such thing. These interactions are, I mentioned, are obtained in the limit where the size of the bulk is infinite. I mean, you think of the size of the bulk to be millimeter, the string scale to be a TV. Then, in practice, these are the interactions of the Goldstino with the fermions which live on the brain. Now, the breaking of supersymmetry in the bulk will introduce a mass for the Goldstino, which is inverse millimeter. And this will give also, you can represent it also with the interactions with the gravitino. But I'm writing here the interaction with the brain field. Is it clear?
This is probably something I should ask you again later, but just this one?
Yes. Then there is no interaction.
Right.
Then there is no interaction of the Goldstein. Yes, but not with the Goldstein. Because the Goldstein becomes massless in that case.
I thought the Goldstein was defined as being the thing that's linearly mixing with the gravitino. I'm not getting this. This sounds like I said.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you should be careful. In this limit, the gravitino, in the limit where the bulk is infinite, the gravitino is massless as well.
Okay.
I mean, you have an exact supergravity in the bulk and exact nonlinear supersymmetry on the brain with non-supersymmetric spectrum. So that is the configuration that you just have in mind. So now that was the first point, which was just to describe you the mechanism. Now is the first consequence that I would like to discuss, in relation to what I mentioned yesterday, is the case of U1 masses. So various, you remember that I described yesterday various forces that you can have in the bulk. Let me see, find it here. So, on the one hand, you have the gravitino, let's say. On the other hand, you have scalars like the radion, which has a small mass and a coupling of order one with gravity. But in general, you can have also gauge fields. And in this case, they could mediate small forces in that region that I described yesterday. So the question is, under what conditions you can have in the bulk light gauge fields? Obviously, if they are massless, then they are excluded. So the question is, under what conditions you can generate in the bulk gauge fields with very small masses? Gauge fields are associated to gauge interactions. So if you break a gauge interaction by, let's say, something like a Higgs mechanism, then in general the masses that you generate are of the order of the string scale. They're not small. So you have to... the question is under what conditions you can have naturally small masses for gauge fields in the bulk. And one possibility to generate such small masses is when these gauge fields have anomalies in the bulk. So, and the masses are generated by anomalies. So that is, I'm going to... This is the motivation... And this is what I'm going to describe now. So in four dimensions, if you have U1 anomalies, then these anomalies could be cancelled by the so-called Green-Schwarz mechanism. In other words, which is generic in string theories. In other words, under a gauge transformation, you introduce an axion which transforms under a gauge transformation in a way to cancel the anomaly. If you forget this green term, the theory has, let's say, this is the anomalous U1. Anomalous means that it has a trace, for instance, different than zero. And therefore, when you do a gauge transformation, it changes with an FF dual term. Now, this axion... the theory contains axions, and this axion couples to FF dual with coefficients which are proportional to the anomalies, to the mixed anomalies. And therefore, in order to cancel this anomaly, you must transform the axion under gauge transformation. Now, if you transform the axion under gauge transformation, then the kinetic term is modified, and then you generate a mass for the U1, which is its coupling constant times the relevant scale, which is the string scale here. This is MA, sorry, yes, of course. in string theory, this axion is in fact a dual to a two form. Which comes from the Ramon-Ramon sector of the closed string. So it's a closed string state, which is which comes from the Ramon-Ramon sector, and they correspond to they come from the twisted sector. In other words, they correspond to closed strings which are localized in orbifold singularities. These fields. Now. I will motivate in a moment, but just let me just mention what happens in six dimensions. In six dimensions, you can also have U1 anomalies, but now a two form is not dual to an axion. So there are two ways to cancel this six dimension anomalies by an axion which is either a two form or a pseudoscalar, which in this case is dual to a four form. Now, these two type of axions cancel the anomalies which correspond to mixed anomalies which correspond to these two type of graphs. Now, the blue line corresponds is the line of the anomalous U1, and the green lines correspond to the various other gauge fields. the anomaly graphs now are 4 points and not 3 points in 6 dimensions. And therefore, you can have either two anomalous U1s and two Gates fields, or one anomalous U1 and three Gates fields. Then in the first case, you need a two form to cancel the anomaly, while in this case, you need a zero form, a pseudoscalar. The difference with respect to the four-dimensional case is that in the case that you have a pseudoscalar, the interaction is similar to the four-dimensional case. However, in the case where the action is a two-form, you see that it does not get a mass. There is no term with the mass. So a two-form in 6 dimensions cancels the U1 anomalies but do not give a mass to the Gates field. Now imagine that you compactify this theory to 4 dimensions. Then you generate, I started with a 6-dimensional anomalous theory, and I compactify toroidal to 4 dimensions. Now the 4-dimensional theory obviously has no anomaly because the spinor is non-chiral in 4 dimensions. A chiral spinor in 6 dimensions give one chiral, one anti-chiral spinor in 4. So there is no anomaly in 4 dimensions. However, these terms are still there. In the first case, the U1 acquires a mass. In the second case, the U1 acquires a mass, while in the first case, it does not acquire a mass. So the first case is normal because you have a U1 which has no anomaly, so it does not require a mass. However, in the second case, although you have a non-anomalous U1, still it acquires a mass due to the 6-dimensional anomaly. So the effective field theory in this case is the same as the one that I described in the case of an anomalous U1. However, this coefficient vanishes. So that is this discussion, therefore, is important because it tells you that sometimes you can have U1 Gates fields which are not anomalous from the four-dimensional point of view, but still they can acquire a mass due to a 6-dimensional anomaly. And indeed, these properties can be confirmed by direct string computation in orientifolds. So the relevant diagram that you have to calculate is directly the two-point function of a Gates field, which can acquire a mass. And the mass arises from a contact term from a graph which is has the topology of the annulus with the two Gates fields at the end. In a supersymmetric theory, there are in the orbifolds, there are three possible sectors that can contribute to this amplitude, depending how many supersymmetries they preserve. So the n equal 4 sectors preserve 4 supersymmetries and give vanishing contribution in this graph. The n equal 2 sectors preserve 2 supersymmetries and can give rise to to masses which are localized in 6 dimensions, so in 4 dimensions in the internal space. These contributions are non-vanishing if there are 6-dimensional anomalies. And then there are n equal 1 sectors which can give 4-dimensional masses localized in all 6 dimensions in the internal space. So you obtain some generic formula for the mass of the U1. And the conclusion is exactly that you have two type of masses. Masses that are localized in 4 dimensions, so in the whole internal space. And they are associated to 4-dimensional U1 anomalies, and masses that are localized in 6 dimensions, and these are associated to 6-dimensional anomalies. So by applying these results to the models in which you have brain and bulk, you can realize the various possibilities for the localization of the Gates field and the corresponding action which gives the mass to the Gates field. So the Gates field can be either on the brain or in the bulk, and similarly the action, and you get these four possibilities. Depending on possibility, you get different type of masses and the couplings for the U1. For instance, if if the anomalous U1 lives on, let's say, on the brain, and the axion lives on the brain, then obviously the mass that you generate is order one in string units, and the coupling is order one. Then this possibility is where the Gates field is localized on the brain, but the axion that cancels the anomalies is a bulk field. Is experimentally excluded because it gives you a mass which is for the U1 which is suppressed by the volume of the bulk along which the axion propagates, but the coupling remains of order one. So that means that the mass U is very light, but the coupling is of order one. So this possibility is obviously excluded. However, the other two possibilities survive, are in principle possible. And this provides a mechanism in which you can generate small masses for U1 field due to anomalies which live in the bulk. So, for instance, in the second case where the Gates field is in the bulk, but the axion is on the brain, in other words, that the mass, in that case, the mass that you generate for the Gates field is localized, you get a mass which is very small, suppressed by the volume of the bulk, and has also a coupling, a Gates coupling, which is suppressed also by the volume of the bulk. In this case, you can generate new submillimeter forces because the coupling, if you take the bulk to be the whole, the bulk where the gravity propagates, then the mass is at the same, order of magnitude as inverse millimeter, 10 to the minus 4 electron volt approximately. The Gates coupling is 10 to the minus 16. However, as I mentioned yesterday, this Gates coupling leads to forces compared to gravity, which are a million or 10 to the 8 times stronger. And the reason is that gravity couples with derivatives, while Gates interactions have no derivative. In that case, the supernova constraints restricts the dimensionality of the bulk to be bigger than 4. Otherwise, that was also someone asked the question yesterday. Finally, in this case, where both are bulk, then you see that the masses increase. So the Kaluza-Klein masses become of the Gates field becomes heavy. So these forces become unobservable because the wavelengths are shorter than inverse millimeter. So this is the conclusion is that this is a way to generate small masses for U1s in the bulk. For instance, one such possibility could be you could imagine to be a U1 which gauges the baryon number, which could have this property. Yes. The computation, this. The sixth dimension. Yes.
Right, so my question for the second is for the zero form.
Yes.
The inclusion of those terms is not cancel the other gauge anomaly. So you have a U1 times an HUN cube.
Yes.
So I understand that these terms cancel the U1 anomaly. How about the HUA, the anomaly under?
Yeah, there are additional conditions for this.
So you need to include more.
Yeah, in other words, there are, but this has nothing to do with the U1. I mean, you have the proper non-abelian anomalies correspond to graphs which contain four green lines. So four lines of the type of Gates field, which has nothing to do with the U1.
Restricting to this diagram, I wonder about what happens under these transformations of the other Gates group.
One way to understand this is to think in terms of the anomaly polynomial. No? There is a first term which depends only on the is f to the four term of the non-abelian type. Those which have irreducible trace must cancel, so you obtain one condition, and then you have reducible terms. So this is one type of non-reducible terms which require a zero form to cancel the anomaly.
Yes.
Yes.
So then,
if it is of this type. If it is of that type, then you need the two forms. So.
Reducible.
In this case, it's the product. Irreducible is the first anomaly, the one that the non-abelian. Yes.
How do you define this
collection
DA plus
ML?
Do you have some kind of data function? In your
Lagrangian,
you have
delta functions. Yeah, the A is a localized field on the brain. Okay.
So small A or large A?
Sorry?
Small A or large A, axiom of the cage theory. You have two A's, right?
Sorry, yes. Yes.
Okay, the cage theory, the brain.
Yes, so the brain kinetic terms is F mu nu square, let's say, where F mu nu of this capital A.
D small A
yes.
plus M large A.
Ah, then you need the delta function.
In front of this M large A.
Yes. That's good. Yeah, it's as usual, there's a delta function. So let me summarize that in all cases that I described previously, independently what particular one you consider, the mass of the U1 is smaller than a string scale and can vary from an order of magnitude up to very small. So independent of whether this U1 generates new forces at short distances with change gravity, certainly they also generate new effects in accelerators, which are due to the production of these U1s, which are lighter than a string scale, plus they are possible Kaluza-Klein excitations if they are if they live in part of the bulk. So that is the first conclusion. The second conclusion is that for model building, normally there are extra conditions for the U1 hypercharge to remain massless. It is not sufficient to be absent of four-dimensional anomalies. You must be sure that there are no anomalies in all six-dimensional limits. Otherwise, even if it is not anomal, if it has no four-dimensional anomalies, if it has six-dimensional anomalies, then it is it will acquire a mass. And one way to satisfy these conditions is to make the U1 part of a non-abelian group in the various decompactification limits. Third remark contains supersymmetry breaking models. If the brain supersymmetry breaking is due to the combinations of brains with orientifolds, then the annulus graph that I mentioned that generates the mass of the Gates field is not affected, because these diagrams in fact correspond to a breaking of supersymmetry in the Mobius amplitude if you have a brain with an orientifold, and therefore the results that I mentioned before remain to be valid. However, in the case that where you have brains and antibrains, then there are some additional contributions which can easily be computed. And
yes. The second remark for the U1 hypercharge anomaly.
Yes.
Can you give us an example where you need the additional conditions in the 4D? I thought 6D anomalies can be cancelled by this two forms and zero forms that you mentioned before. So is there?
You need a zero form, then the U1 will become massive. That's the point.
Okay, so the question is, you see,
so the condition
is actually broken.
Right.
In nature,
right.
So that it be possible to consider the case where it's an anomaly that breaks the U1 hypercharge.
These additional conditions is that in case that the hypercharge has anomalies in six dimensions, this condition should ensure that these anomalies must cancel by a two form and not by an axiom, so that it remains massless.
Yeah, I understand, but I'm asking, why do you need U1 hypercharge to remain massless?
Oh, because then it's, we find a model which is inconsistent with observation.
No, in the standard model, U1 hypercharge is broken.
Yeah, but it's broken at the low. It's broken by Higgs, by not because of anomaly.
Yes. I mean, that seems to be that first the TV, maybe there is a layer.
Okay, could be. Yeah. Yeah, you need a mass which is an order of magnitude lower than the string scale, for instance. Now, okay, up to now, other properties, just want to give you some outlook of what other properties I was planning to mention, but I have to now to make a choice because of time. First is the possibility of electroweak symmetry breaking. Now the idea here is I will just discuss the main ideas because in any case I have something like 10 minutes. So the idea here is that you would like to explain why the Higgs, the electroweak vacuum expectation value of the Higgs is 200, let's say, GeV and not a TeV where the string scale is. It's an order of magnitude less than the string scale. So one way to do it is to identify the Higgs with among the massless spectrum of a non-supersymmetric brain. And then, since this brain is not supersymmetric, the radiative corrections in general will give a mass to the scalar, and the question is whether this radiative mass that is generated can be negative. You see, this mass that you will generate is cut off by the string scale, which plays the role of the ultraviolet cutoff. So, in fact, this is the essence of stability of the hierarchy by TeV strings. The divergence is cut off by the string scale. But then, since it is generated at the one loop, it has a loop factor suppression. So if this contribution is negative, then this can drive electroweak symmetry breaking. And in fact, okay, what I had in mind is to describe you some examples in which this indeed can happen. And by this way, you can realize an analog of a Kolmann-Weinberg mechanism, but now with no logs. It's just a calculable negative mass square coefficient. Now, another property that I would like to mention is that you could try to use this idea of having anomalous U1s in order to guarantee that a baryon on the lepton number corresponds to a global symmetry. The reason for that is that if you have a U1 which becomes, which has anomaly, and which or not, and which becomes massive in any case by the mechanism that I mentioned because of anomalies, four-dimensional, six-dimensional anomalies, then this U1 acquires a mass, but the global symmetry, associated symmetry, the global U1 remains unbroken. So this is one way to, for instance, to construct models in which the baryon number corresponds to global symmetry. If you gauge the baryon number in the bulk, then we know that the baryon in particular has an anomaly, so it will acquire a mass. However, the global part will remain as a symmetry. And this indeed can be done in various examples. And this is one way to protect proton decay. Similarly, you can do the same thing for the lepton number. Now, the lepton number is not needed so much, let's say, for as strongly as the case of baryon for proton decay. However, you need the lepton number if you want to have right neutrinos in the bulk. You see, one way to generate small masses for neutrinos that have been proposed in the literature, it has been discussed, analyzed by various groups, is to to identify the right neutrino with some state which lives in the bulk. In that case, it would acquire its mass will be suppressed naturally by the volume of the bulk. However, you must guarantee that the lepton number is a global symmetry. Otherwise, you can have dimension 5 operators or dimension 6 operators that can give mass to the right neutrino, which is much higher. So this is one way to satisfy this requirement by promoting the lepton number to symmetry. Finally, last topic that I would like to discuss was alternatives of gauge coupling unification. I don't know what to say because there is no much time left. The idea is that people had asked also a question yesterday. One of the problems in general of this approach that has criticized this approach is the fact that the standard unification of couplings cannot be accommodated. Cannot be accommodated. Now, the problem of unification couplings is, however, much more general in string theory. In other words, if you remember what happens in the heterotic string, you have a high scale. However, you obtain an additional prediction. You predict the unification scale because, by definition, at the string scale, all the couplings meet, all the gauge couplings become equal. However, unfortunately, the prediction that you get for the unification scale is wrong by two orders of magnitude. So that means that you have to do something to cure this problem, and therefore you lose the nice prediction. I mean, okay, you may say if you need to extrapolate 16 orders of magnitude, then something can happen that to explain this discrepancy. However, if you take this problem seriously, then you need to introduce some parameter. For instance, you need to introduce some volume of compactification, which is large, two orders of magnitude larger than a string scale, or something else. So what I want to say here is that in general, the question of gauge coupling unification does not have a nice implementation in the context of string theory, either because string theory predicts the long unification scale, or in the case of these models, because the string scale is very low. There have been various discussions and proposals in the literature. One is to introduce power law running of the couplings, in which case the low energy couplings become very sensitive in the initial conditions because threshold corrections become very important. Another is to use the logarithmic corrections when the bulk is two-dimensional and replace the running in energy space by some effective running in position space when you have two extra dimensions. The problem there is that although the idea is nice, there has been no known example which can replace can fix the coefficients of these logs to be identical to the n equal 1 supersymmetric beta function. So, okay, the idea remains, but there is no example that can make it work. Another possibility is to take the unification as an accident and try to find another way to again to get a prediction on the sine square theta but on some different by some different idea. And one such possibility is by using the fact that you have several brains. In other words, if you try to construct the standard model in the context of these theories, then in general you need the two type of brains in order to describe the strong and electroweak interactions, one for the strong and one for the electroweak. Therefore, you need to introduce two dependent couplings, one for the SU3 and the other for the SU2. The U1 could be a linear combination. So in principle, you can evade the problem to introduce a third coupling. So the question is whether by embedding the standard model in two sets of brains, which describe strong and weak interactions, you can reproduce a prediction for the sine square theta, which looks differently than ordinary unification, but still it gives you a prediction that it works if the string scale is of the order of the TV. So this is the idea that I would like to, I had in mind to discuss more precisely. And indeed, you obtain models in which this can be satisfied. So I think I will stop here. I don't know if you have questions, I can show you more precisely.
Thank you.